written the way it is. And so we had a little discussion in the back. I'm sorry I took up some committee time for that. There's a couple things I wanted to mention to committee. First of all, I want to remind you of next Tuesday. Please be here at 7:30. There will be food in the hall. We have been told that is the very last time that we'll ever be allowed to have food in the hall because they don't like the fact that we're bringing food in here. So next Tuesday, perhaps you could gobble most of your food in the hall. So I know when we're, and here we are eating donuts, I know.
Who's that?
I don't know. The powers that be sent us a notice that that was the last time they would approve. I think we're the bosses around here, aren't we? Representative Carlson.
When we were in Detroit, and we had a speaker that played Van Coffee, and Minnesota, you just don't do that.
You know, coffee was not mentioned. Food was mentioned.
That speaker rescinded his coffee.
You kicked that speaker out, right?
No, I think he survived that conflict, but that probably was the beginning of the end, maybe. I don't know. So that's why I asked who they is.
I think they might be somewhere over in the direction of the speaker's office. But I'm not sure the speaker knows anything about it.
It seems the whole majority.
Thank you, Representative Latz. Okay. There's a couple things, folks, that I'm wondering if you're interested in hearing this year that I think are matters of interest to this committee, but we're going to have to find a way to squeeze them into the time that we have. And one would be a hearing that pretty much centered on the permanent school trust fund lands, and then a small bill, resolution, whatever you call it, regarding the trust fund lands. I think you ought to have some understanding of how they're currently being managed, how much we're making from them, how many of them there are, et cetera. So I would like to find, I'm trying to find a time to devote one meeting to that. Also, we had asked the colleges to do some reporting on the people going into education, how much time they spend student teaching, how many college professors actually ever go to a school anymore, to a high school or a grade school, and have any understanding of what's going on in schools. And they have completed that report, and I know higher ed needs to hear it, and we need to hear it. And so we're going to try and find a time that's mutually agreeable with higher ed and us to hear that report. And then I just learned a couple, I guess last week, that there's been a study done by the University of Minnesota in conjunction with 12 school districts on parent involvement. And it looks at fifth graders today whose records go back far enough so that they can see whether or not those children took part in ECFE when they were young, and to see if there's any correlation with whether or not parents stay involved after they have had those kinds of classes. And that's another report that I think would be very informative for us. And it's one of the few times we've had research that does some kind of evaluation of some of our early childhood programs. So I'm going to try and find a time also to get that in. And then if there are other things that you think you would like to make sure we hear, I think we could sometimes use the Wednesday morning 8:15 time, because I don't think most of you have a committee on Wednesday morning. Is there anybody here who does have a committee on Wednesday morning at 8:15? Yay. We can meet 3 days a week. We'll try not to abuse that privilege. Okay, the bill that we have before us today is just one bill. I thought we would have another bill, but it didn't make the deadline to be heard today. So we don't have that. This is the department's bill. It is partly technical, partly other things. Representative Meslow, would you like to run the committee, please?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Olson has not arrived yet. And we have a number of people from the department, so let's just go to the desk. Also, the donuts were brought by the department.
Yeah.
It's in the budget.
We're now here to discuss House File Number 1789, Representative Sikora, to your bill.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move 1789 be passed, recommended to pass, and sent on to government operations. There is something in here that would force it to go to GovOps. And then I also have an amendment. This is a purely technical amendment. It's 0828. It should be with your bill in your packet. If you want to look at page 19, line 23, you can see that it is a pretty incidental amendment. And then, Mr. Chairman, I would like to add to this amendment to delete section 9. Let's see what page. I think that's page 22.
Okay, section 9.
And I'll tell you why. This deals with the, the academic standards. And it was to simply say that the process would be the same as last year. But since they have the date of the standards of January 15th, I don't think we can do this section. This will have to go with the standards bill.
All right.
So I'm suggesting we delete all of section 9.
That would be on page 22, lines 11 through 35?
That's correct. No, actually, yes, 11 through 35.
Thank you.
So I would like to move my amendment, be adopted.
So noted. And at this point, I'd like to, if we could walk through it section by section, Representative Sikora?
We should pass the amendment first.
All right. True.
Are there any questions about the amendment?
Yes. Representative Barnett.
Mr. Chair, shouldn't you also be deleting Section 10 dealing with rulemaking authority if that's going to be... I know you want to set that correct term to ops, but should that be deleted as well since you're not dealing with the standards anymore?
Section 10, Representative, deals with supplemental education service providers, the people that are going to be allowed to provide services for students in schools where they've been under AYP for a period of time. They then have to provide those students some services, and there are service providers that will be allowed to provide those services who are applying right now. And there would be an ongoing need as different people come forward or different organizations come forward to provide those services. There would be an ongoing need for those services. And so the commissioner would have to be able to authorize those people to provide services. So it can't be just a fly-by-night somebody coming along and looking for a little school district money to tutor a child. Does that make sense?
Representative Barnett, does that answer your question? Thank you. Are there any other questions as to the author's amendments? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Now, Representative Sikora, if you would identify the person sitting to your left, if he would identify himself, and if we could move through the bill article by article, that would be helpful.
Mr. Melcher from the department. I think you all know Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and members, good morning. My name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Program Finance Director at the Department of Education, and I'll be walking through Article 1 of the bill. Beginning on page 1, the first section of the bill, the actual language is on page 3 of the bill. It deletes a requirement that was enacted in 1998 that requires each school superintendent in the state to submit a report to the department annually by January 10th providing an estimate of the expenditures the district believes would be required to reach an 80% student passage rate on the basic standards test. Also deletes a requirement for the school districts to submit a report on how much the district is cross-subsidizing programs for special education basic skills revenue with general education revenue. The cross-subsidy piece of this that is being deleted is replaced later in the bill with a requirement for the Department of Education to provide that same information. And in fact, school districts already report all of the data that we need to determine those cross-subsidies through regular online reporting, and this is simply a kind of a duplicative requirement for the superintendent. So we're simply eliminating one step in the process and using the data that districts have already submitted in order for us to provide that information to the public. With respect to the report on expenditures and passage rates, this was something that was enacted in 1998 when the basic standards test was very new. There was an interest in what the cost would be for districts to implement programs that would be needed for students to attain a certain level of success on the basic standards test. In recent years, there has not been so much interest in this report. Quite frankly, the report has never produced what I would call accurate or verifiable data. It's simply a ballpark estimate provided by school districts of a bottom line number that they felt was needed to reach this level. The department has collected the data each year, maintained that. We did have quite a few legislative hearings and interest in this in the first couple of years. We've had very little interest since then. The superintendents have come to us and said it's a reporting burden. We don't see a great return on continuing this one, and we're recommending that report be eliminated. Section 2 of the bill is a technical change updating the name of a manual that the department uses for student activity fund accounting. The old name dates back to the era when area vocational technical schools were part of the department. The name of the manual has since been changed. This is simply a technical correction to update the reference to a manual to reflect the current name of the manual. Section 3 of the bill is a technical provision that is simply clarifying the definition of the two components of debt service equalization aid. We have a two-tiered formula, and this is simply defining what's in Tier 1 and what's in Tier 2. That definition will be used in a later section of the bill when we make adjustments for districts that have paid off all of their debts, and there's an adjustment where if they have surplus funds left over, we do some recoveries of the balances that are left. Section 4 of the bill is dealing with the reporting of expenditures by building through the Uniform Financial Accounting and Reporting Standards, or UFAR system. Since 1999, we have had a requirement in law for school districts to allocate general education revenue by building and do reporting on that basis. The department is proposing that provision be repealed, and the language in that provision is on the very last page of the bill, and replaced with this new language. The language on lines 9 through 11 on page 5 is identical to the existing language that would be repealed, and that's just simply defining an educational building site. The language in paragraph D on page 5 is providing more detail in terms of the types of revenues and expenditures that school districts must be reporting on a building-by-building level. The current language that is proposed to be repealed simply requires each district to maintain separate accounts to identify revenues and expenditures by building. The proposed language does not require districts to identify revenues or track revenues by building. That's always been a problematic thing and created a lot of extra work for school districts. And what it does is it focuses more on which expenditures need to be identified by building. Currently, we have a lot of variability in terms of the reporting that we get from the school districts, and we felt it would be more helpful as we do comparisons across school districts to provide more specificity on what types of expenditures need to be reported by building. And so what the language in the bill does is it specifies that we're looking specifically at the general fund of school districts, excluding capital expenditures and pupil transportation, and that all expenditures for regular instruction, secondary vocational instruction, and school building level administration must be reported to the department by building, that expenditures for special education instruction, instructional support services, that would be things like librarians, media centers, pupil support services, which would include things like guidance counselors, would be reported by building to the extent that those activities are occurring within a specific building. So if you had, for example, a district-wide curriculum coordinator, that would not need to be identified by building because it's a district-wide kind of thing, but a librarian that was in a specific building, a guidance counselor in a specific building, would be identified at the building level. Would also require that salary expenditures that are reported in UFARS be identified based on actual salaries and not based on prorating of average salary per teacher across all of the buildings. These are all things that are contained in the kind of guidelines currently in our Uniform Financial Accounting and Reporting Manual, but they're not clear in statute. We have a great deal of variability, and what we're trying to do is reach a level where we can provide more uniform, clear, understandable reporting to the public in terms of the expenditures across different buildings and different school districts as part of our department website. So what we're trying to do is accomplish the initial intent of this legislation that was on the back page, but to do it in a way that's more clearly defined, more uniform, that focuses on those specific revenue categories in the general fund and tries to get all of the districts kind of on the same page doing things in a similar way so that we have more valid comparisons across the districts. Paragraph C of this provision on line 25 on page 5 would require the department to annually report this information on the department's website. Our intent is that a year down the road that we would be including school building level information on the school district report cards that we first made available last summer. We would not do that this coming summer because the districts have already submitted the data for the 2002-2003 school year, but we would be including both building level and district level expenditure breakdowns on the report card starting with the fiscal 04 data that we would have, not this coming summer, but the following summer. And there's also some direction to the department here in terms of identifying revenues by building. Currently, we ask the districts to identify revenues by building. For the major categories of revenue, the department already, since we do the calculations, we know exactly what the revenues are and how much are being generated. This provides some direction to the department for a uniform way of identifying revenue generated by students at each building. And it essentially says that the basic skills revenue will be identified by building based on the count of free and reduced lunch students at each building, the way it's actually generated in the formula. The first grade preparedness aid would be identified by building. There are certain sites that generate that first grade preparedness based on a poverty count, certain ones that don't. And that other other revenues would be allocated by building on a per pupil basis, with the exception of special education in Title I, where the revenue, because it's a percentage reimbursement of expenditures, would be reported by building in proportion to the expenditures. Okay. Section 5 of the bill on page 6. Is making some clarifications on another related piece of legislation that ties into this allocation of revenue among buildings report. What it currently requires is for each school district to calculate the amount of general education revenue that it estimates will be generated by pupils in each building and inform the site as to the amount of those revenues prior to the adoption of the budget at the beginning of the school year. The department currently does a calculation of those revenue amounts and informs the school districts of those amounts. Quite often, it's difficult for the school district to come up with accurate estimates of these numbers before the start of the school year because of the legislative session closing up not so long before the school year or before the fiscal year begins. We think the simplest thing to be done here is simply for the districts to use the department's calculations of the general education revenue generated by students at each building, which are based on the runs that we produce at the end of each legislative session. And the districts would then pass those along rather than developing a new set of runs. We do provide an exception here that if the district has had a change, new information that's something the department would not have, they are, of course, allowed to make changes. So, for example, if they had a building opening or a building closing, we've calculated compensatory revenue based on the prior year's distribution of students. They would make some adjustment to that and then report to the department how they've reallocated that compensatory revenue. Then the department would, in turn, use those revised numbers as we do this other report that identifies the revenue generated by students at each building. It's an attempt to streamline the process and make it a little bit more uniform. Okay. Section 6 of the bill on page 7 is deleting an obsolete reference to the capital expenditure fund. That fund was eliminated back in 1997 and rolled into the general fund of the school districts. Section 7 is updating the charter school law to reflect the changes made in the 2003 legislative session in the components of general education revenue. So it adds their cross-references to the extended time revenue and the transition revenue that were added in the 2003 legislation. Section 8 is eliminating an obsolete cross-reference to a paragraph C that no longer exists. This language was rewritten a couple of years ago, and paragraph C was rolled into one large subdivision as opposed to having a separate paragraph, so there's no longer a need to have a reference to that paragraph. Section 9 of the bill on page 9 would authorize the commissioner to withhold state aid payments to a school district if the school district failed to submit audited annual financial statements and audited annual financial data in conformance with the UFAR's reporting statute. This is an area where we have had a significant number of school districts and charter schools that have not been timely in terms of providing information to the state that we then use in calculating final aid payments to school districts and preparing reports such as the profiles report, the report card, and other kinds of reports. Our intent is that we would never have to actually withhold aid from a district, and this is not a permanent reduction. It would be basically a withholding until we get the information. But it's just to send a message to the school districts that it is important to provide audited financial data to the department. Without that data, we can't provide good information to the legislature. We can't work with school districts that are in statutory operating debt to help them develop a plan to get out of debt. And there are a lot of due process protections in this. This is not something that the department would implement in any kind of easy offhand manner. There's a very thorough process in law where the department would provide a formal written notice to the school superintendent and the school board. The school board has an opportunity to provide a response to the department if they believe that there's been some mistake. There's a process for a formal hearing. All of that would probably take 3 or 4 months before the department at the earliest would be looking at any sort of aid withholding from a school district. Section 11 of the bill, Section 10 is related to Section 9. It's part of the same discussion. Section 11 of the bill is providing a clarification on residency for children of separated parents. It's just adding or separated to current language that relates to residency for divorced parents. It essentially allows those parents to identify the residency where the two separated parents have some sort of joint custody of the child. And we need this for a number of state aid sort of calculations. For example, in the area of special education, the residency determines which district is responsible for developing the program and so forth. Section 12 on cross-subsidy reports is requiring the department by January 30th each year to estimate how much each district is cross-subsidizing the cost of special education and basic skills programs with general education revenues. This is the same report that is currently being produced under the language that's being stricken on page 3 of the bill, and this reflects the current practice. The school districts provide us with the basic data. We're already doing this calculation and posting it. By making this a department report rather than a superintendent's report, we're simply eliminating a step where the department does the calculations, we send it to the district signs off on it, sends it back to us. It's just making the process a little bit more efficient and still producing the same information. Section 13 is a technical section dealing with the way the school district certifies its tax levy. It eliminates obsolete language relating to the general education levy that was repealed by the 2001 legislature. And it clarifies the breakdown of the tax levy that the department provides to the county auditor for purposes of the truth in taxation notices. And this is just simply stating more clearly what we're already providing to the county auditors as we are directed by the revenue department. Section 14 of the bill deals with the recovery of surplus funds when a school district has paid off its debt service on long-term debt. This is an update of the law to reflect the new two-tiered debt service equalization aid formula. The way that this works is school districts are annually levying 105% of what they need to make their principal and interest payments on their debts. And so by the time a district has paid off all of its debts, and if it's not going to be issuing new debt, there's a process currently in law where the surplus that's left after all the debts have been paid is returned in part to the taxpayers and returned in part to the state, depending on what part of the dollars came from the taxpayers in the first place and what part of the dollars came from state equalization aid. And what this does is updates the law to reflect the two-tiered formula so that if a district was receiving second-tier equalization aid in the last year that they were being funded, that we would then be calculating how much of that money being returned would come from aid and levy based on that second-tier formula. So it's reflecting the latest formula rather than the previous formula, which had only one tier. And Section 15 of the bill is the repealer of the language in Section 126C23, which appears on the back of the bill and is being replaced with Section 4.
Thank you, Mr. Melcher. Questions as to Article 1? Representative Segrin, did you have a question for Mr. Melcher?
Yes. Mr. Melcher, going back to the state aid withholding situation, what's the percentage of school districts and charter schools that don't submit their financial data? And then what are the reasons why when you, find out that they haven't, what are the reasons that they are given when that happens?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Segrin, last year, the legislative auditor did a study of charter school finances, and in that study, they cited some statistics from the 2002 annual reporting. They noted that 29% of charter schools and 14% of school districts failed to meet the statutory November 30th deadline for reporting audited UFARS data for fiscal year 02, and that 29% of charter schools and 12% of school districts failed to meet the statutory December 30th deadline for submission of audited financial reports. This year, the numbers are a little worse than that, in part because there are a lot of districts that this year are implementing the GASB 34 requirements for the first time. Most of the districts that are late are not late by huge lengths of time. The majority of those that are late come in within a month of the original submission date. So it's just simply a matter of priorities in the district, getting the auditor out and scheduled to get that report done on a timely basis. One of the things we found is that the districts that are late in submitting the reports more often than not tend to be those districts that are having some financial difficulties as well. And those are the districts that we most need to have the reports in on a fairly timely basis so that we can, for example, work with the district in developing a statutory operating debt plan. It's very rare for the districts to be several months late on this, and when they are, there is usually some issue with the audit that needs to be resolved between the school district and the auditor. Well, we still have, I think, one charter school that has not submitted its audit report from 2002, so it would be about a year late. That makes it very difficult for us to calculate and determine what the final aid was that was due to that district, and in some cases it'll affect, for example, whether we need to prorate the aid for other school districts. And we do have some kind of month-by-month sorts of tracking sheets on the individual cases, but for example, we have 55 school districts this year that didn't submit their audit information on time, but we were down to 15 as of last week that still had not submitted. That'd be about a month late.
Follow-up?
Representative Segrin.
So in the legislation, you're saying by December 30th then, if they haven't submitted, or is it the November date?
Mr.
Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Segrin, the bill would say if the district is late, the department would be authorized under Section 127A42 to withhold aid payments until they submit the information. So we have two dates, the November 30th date for the audited UFARS data. I think it's December 31st for the actual audit from the CPA firm that's doing the audit with the school district. As a practical matter, I think the way that the process would work, we currently send reminder letters out to districts, probably a week after the due date, and say, well, we didn't get your report. And in some cases, just they forgot to mail us a copy of it. They have the report, they just didn't send it. Probably the way that we would work this would be we would send out that report just like we always have. If it got to be, let's say, a month late, we would probably at that point be at the process of sending a more formal notice, and that's the first step in the process under 127A42, where a notice would go to the superintendent and the school board chair, basically putting them on official notice that we have not received that document and that failure to submit it within a reasonable period of time. The commissioner would need to set an amount of time in that letter. We might say another month. It would depend on what they've given us. If there are truly some extenuating circumstances, we would be receptive to that.
Representative Segrin?
Mr. Chair, I guess my point is I'm wondering if some of the school districts that are, if there's rural districts, small districts that, maybe don't have the financial expertise sometimes, if they are getting into some kind of financial problems, if there's any, when those kinds of things are identified, if the department can actually, instead of just saying, okay, well, now we're going to start taking away your aid, say, if you've got some financial problems, how can we help you, or what? I always, we always talk about the department being a service organization, but we always end up being kind of the penalty organization instead. Well, you haven't followed the law, so now we're going to set up things to punish you instead of saying, and I'm not saying that, and there certainly can be egregious circumstances where there just is not a, it's just not being done well, and mm-hmm. they're avoiding mm-hmm. the timelines. But and it sounds like you are going, you try to do that, but I'm just a little concerned about, you know, starting to withhold aid unless there's, and if there are just some processes where they were late or they're struggling with something, and it's going to take 3 or 4 months before you ever do anything anyway, it would seem like that time would be more well spent just trying to get them, you know, back on track with their financial reporting. But just my comment.
Do you have any response to that, Mr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seeger, I would only say that our first priority is always to try to work with the district to try to get things resolved. We just think it just helps to have in the background somewhere that ultimately the district does need to submit audited financial information to the department. It is important. We do rely on it. It's not just affecting that school district. It's affecting other school districts. And just so that in the back of their mind, they know that ultimately there is some accounting for having to submit audited financial information. We do have large districts, small districts. The smaller districts tend to rely more heavily on their auditors to do that work. And certainly, as we work with a school district, if there is any sort of reasonable way we can work with them to get things done, if they have any sort of reasonable reason why they need more time, that's all part of this process. And we certainly not have any intent of aggressively going after districts just so we can withhold their money. That's certainly the farthest thing from our mind. We just simply feel like we owe it to the other school districts in the state that have submitted data on a timely basis to be able to calculate the aids for all districts with the final data, to be able to publish information on our website in terms of the financial profiles that school districts across the state rely on, that the parents would have access to information on report cards that we produce, and that at some point school districts just need to be on notice that they do have to comply with that, and that it just simply isn't something that they can ignore.
Representative Eastland, did you have a question to this point?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Melcher, you referred to something, I'm not sure what it is, that is causing schools to, GASB 34 or something like that, that is causing school districts to be delayed in their, mm-hmm. what is that?
Mr. Melcher.
GASB 34, GASB stands for the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, and the GASB 34 is a new requirement that involves the way the districts are doing their financial reporting, and it's being phased in over time. The larger school districts have already been required to comply with this. The smaller districts are doing that this year. And certainly, if school districts are having difficulty because of something like that, that's clearly not the sort of thing that we would be imposing any sort of an aid withholding to address. We're concerned more with the district that, you know, 4 months later, 6 months later, a year later, still hasn't given us audited financial data. We're worried about, are we going to have to go back and try to collect money back from a school because we can't get the information on how much they spent during the year? Those are the kinds of things that we're more worried about. And something like this implementation of GASB 34 would not be the kind of thing we would say, well, gee, you're a month late, we're going to get you. That's not what this is about at all.
Thank you. Representative Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Melcher, two questions unrelated. A follow-up on your discussion just now. It looks like on the language that you proposed for the Subdivision 2, Paragraph B, is a little bit different than that contained in existing law in Paragraph A. Paragraph B says the commissioner may withhold the district's state aid for any school year. Sounds to me like it's all or nothing. Either you wield a sledgehammer or you don't swing anything at all, versus paragraph, the new codified paragraph A, the commissioner may reduce or withhold the district's state aid. I'm wondering if that was your intent, was to have such a blunt enforcement instrument, or if you want a little more flexibility to reduce some part rather than all. of the state aid. And then I can answer that. I'd like to ask my other question.
All right. Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I think our intent was to follow the existing language, which says that we would reduce or withhold up to 60% of the general education aid. That would be on page 10, lines 18 and 19. I believe that the let's check here. I think the references in the current law, for example, on page 8, line 35 and 36, the commissioner may reduce or withhold the district state aid for any school year when the board of the district resident authorizes or permits, and there's a list of things. So I think the way this is structured, this first subdivision just is saying, what are the categories of things that we can either reduce or withhold aid for? And we've got this new paragraph B separated out because we're not asking for authority to actually reduce the district state aid. We only want to have authority to withhold the state aid. So in other words, if in fact we had an egregious kind of violation of this provision and the district was months and months late, we don't want to actually penalize them for the year. We just want to say we're going to withhold some of the dollars in order to, until that report comes in, and then we'll pay it to you. So the only reason for separating out those two paragraphs is this one is only authority to withhold, not authority to reduce. And I think the way these two fit together is then once we've determined this is on the list of things where there's some adjustment possible, then the actual dollar amount would be under the existing language in subdivision 6, which is on the next page, and the actual amount then would be the total amount of state aid which could be reduced or withheld. First of all, it varies based on the period during which the violation continued after the time permitted for correction, and then it would be up to 60% of the basic revenue. So I think we have authority there to withhold a very small amount, and it would only be based on the period of time, or we would begin the withholding as of the, so for example, if the audit report was due in December, mm-hmm. and after repeated attempts to work with the district, we weren't able to resolve this, and we were in, let's say, April. And so we said, okay, we're going to set April 30th as the date. We would then we could then withhold some portion, 60% of the aid that they had coming during the month of April, I mean, up to that amount, if they hadn't submitted the report during the month of April. If they got the thing in at the end of April, we would then, you know, pay that money back to them. I think that's how it would work.
Representative Latz, you indicated you have another question.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Melcher, I'm learning about that withholding process for the first time here, but I don't see anything in that provision which says after a certain period of time we'll send it to you. That might be implied by the term withholding, I don't know, when my taxes are withheld, I don't see them sent back to me later. Might be a permanent withhold. Maybe you want to consider some clarifying language between this step and the next step. My next question, Mr. Chair, had to do with Section 4 on page 5 of the bill, dealing with the separating expenditures out by the building. I guess my question is, how much of a change is this from the existing accounting or financial practices of the local school districts? How much of an effort is it going to take for them to comply with this? And is that going to have a fiscal impact on the local school districts, whether we need to consider asking for a local fiscal impact note on the effects of this provision? And then just technically, does actual salaries on line 22 include benefits such as health insurance, retirement, and paid leave, or just the dollar in the paycheck?
Mr. Melcher.
First of all, I would refer you to the last page of the bill, which subdivision 4 of the current law requires each district to maintain separate accounts to identify revenues and expenditures in each building. So in my view, the language in the new law that is being proposed, this is on the very last, the old law, it's in the repealer section. and I think that would be on the last page of your bill, in the appendix. Subdivision 4 there is the existing requirements. It requires the district to identify both revenues and expenditures by building. What we're doing here is deleting the requirement for the districts to report the revenues by building, keeping the requirement for them to report expenditures by building. So we're actually making things a bit easier for the districts by not requiring this revenue reporting, which is, by the way, the most difficult part for the district. They wouldn't otherwise be doing this revenue piece by building. They typically do maintain expenditure information by building already, both because they're required to by law and for their own purposes. They want to know what the expenditures are for individual buildings. So the intent here, I believe, is to make things a little bit easier for the districts by eliminating the revenue reporting requirement by building. And then just to be a little bit more clear in terms of which items of revenue need to be reported and which items of revenue don't need to be reported. The current requirement is a general one, which would imply all the expenditures need to be reported by building. Here we're narrowing it down to say we're only looking at the general fund, first of all. We're not looking at other funds. And then within the general fund, we're primarily concerned about the instructional and instructional support kinds of activities that are at the building. And with regard to your question about the salary expenditures, we would be looking at the salary piece, not the fringe benefit piece. At least our financial accounting reporting system has two separate account codes for the salary and for the fringe benefits. This is just the salary part.
Mr. Chair, follow-up?
Yes, Representative Lass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Melcher, just my quick reading of the repealer section, Subdivision 4 requires separate accounts for expenditures, and Subdivision 5 appears to only require reporting of the revenue side, unless I'm reading it wrong, or there's another provision requiring reporting of the revenue of the expenditure side. Just my quick cut on it, looks like this is a new reporting requirement for the expenditure side, even if the districts are already maintaining their data in some form by building. Am I reading this correctly?
The existing law also requires the district in Subdivision 3 to adjust the allocations of revenues and expenditures by building. And the way that we're reading this current requirement of law and the way that it's been implemented over the years is that we require the district to tell us or to identify how much general ed revenue they're getting for each building. According to the state formula, you've got X number of pupil units, you're getting $4,601 for each pupil unit. You're also getting some money for free and reduced lunch. The way the current process works, the school district by board action is supposed to say, even though a certain amount has been generated by students at each building, we will, by board action, reallocate some of that money to another building. And it requires kind of a detailed tracking of that revenue dollar and board action to move that revenue dollar to another building and then track the expenditure at that building. And there may be some things we're doing currently that are in between the lines here, but the way the current process works, we're requiring the districts to identify the revenues generated by building, how much they've reallocated to another building, and then the, you know, when you take the revenues plus the reallocations, what you end up with basically is the expenditures at the building, and make that comparison. So the current kinds of reports that we're publishing are comparing the general education revenue components with the expenditures. And one of the reasons why this doesn't work very well is school districts are tracking their revenues on a fund-by-fund basis. So they've got the general fund, for example. General education revenue is one component of the general fund. So we're in a continual game of trying to match up the largest portion, but not all of the general education revenue with the general education expenditures, which creates a further confounding problem for the school districts of trying to figure out, well, which of the expenditures we made came out of general ed revenue as opposed to other general fund revenue. And we thought it would be a lot simpler for the districts if we simply looked at the total bottom line revenue in the general fund and the total expenditures in the general fund, which conforms to the to the way the districts are doing their accounting and reporting. And when you have a requirement for districts to identify revenues and expenditures for each building, there's also another reporting requirement in the UFAR statute, which requires the district to submit annual UFARS reports to the department, which would include those revenues and expenditures that they've identified. So that's where the reporting piece would be.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Melcher, we're looking at page 5, lines 21 through 24 on the reporting of salaries.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be interested in your interpretation of this, because as I read this, I could interpret it that you must report the salaries paid in total to all teachers in a given building. Another way you could read that is that you must report each individual teacher's salaries. So it must reflect actual salaries for mm-hmm. staff at the building. So my first mm-hmm. question is, what is your expectation? The salaries in the aggregate or the reporting of each individual teacher's salaries? And if you could answer that, and I have a follow-up.
Mr. Melton.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, our expectation is that this would be reported in aggregate. This is an amendment to the UFARS statute, and there is a certain code in the UFARS statute for instructional salaries. And that's where we're saying there is when the district reports those instructional salaries through UFARS, it would be the actual salaries for the staff in the building as opposed to, for example, if the average salary in a district was $40,000 for teachers to simply use $40,000 for each teacher throughout the district as they do their UFARS books. This is a long-standing requirement in the UFARS system to report the actual expenditures and not some average.
And then my Representative Carlson. Follow-up is to ask why do you want that information? What is its purpose? Is it to compare the costs of two buildings in the same district? And if there weren't other information that was provided, it could be rather misleading. For example, you might have a slightly more senior staff at one building than at another building, and there might be some other cost drivers that would be reflected in salary, and it wouldn't necessarily be a level playing field when you begin to compare buildings. And so, again, the question is, why do you need it, and what is its purpose?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, what the purpose is to identify the actual dollar resources that are being used in each of the buildings throughout the state. And I think you're correct in saying there would be within districts there would be some buildings that would have higher average salaries than other buildings. This would simply reflect the fact that there are more resources being allocated to that building to pay for those higher salaries for the more senior staff in one building as opposed to another. It's just simply to provide an accurate reflection of what the actual dollar resources are that are being expended at each building site within the state.
Mr. Chairman, and that's
Representative Carlson.
And that's my point. Without some additional information, that could be rather misleading.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't, for example, explain that one building had, for whatever mm-hmm. reason,
mm-hmm.
A slightly older staff and the way teacher salaries currently work, that would generally reflect a higher cost. Or if someone were looking at similar schools in two different school districts and one was a faster growing school district with a lot of younger staff as opposed mm-hmm. to a more mm-hmm. mature staff in an older, more stable district. In my view, you should either ask neither question or not ask the question or provide more information if you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I expect I'd probably come down on the side of maybe a little more information mm-hmm. so that there's not mm-hmm. misunderstanding. So I would just offer that as something to think about as you move forward.
Mr. Melcher, any comments?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I would just add that this is anticipated. This information will be going out on the department's website. and also on the report card information that we produce, which does include a wealth of additional information on the staffing and characteristics of the students, et cetera, for the building. So it would be in a context. It's not isolated from other pieces of information. We can take a look to make sure we've got those kinds of things in there, but I'm pretty sure that a variety of student, staff, and other kinds of data are all together in a convenient format for the reader to see all of that information.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have, you answered my question about the wages per district, because I was wondering how GASB 34 was going to relate to that, but that question was answered. The second question I have is related to the expenses for the buildings for private schools. Currently, public schools are reflecting that in their numbers. Are you going to have a line item that shows the building expenses for, let's say, in my district, Totino Grace, what they get for transportation and textbooks and counseling services? Will that be shown for their building in this report?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bernardi, I'm trying to think how that, I know that the, for example, the non-public pupil textbooks and so forth expenses, those show up in the community service fund of the school districts, and I'm not positive without going back and checking to see if the transportation expenses are handled in a similar way. This reporting we're looking at here would be only the general fund expenses, so it would not include, for example, the textbooks that the school district buys that are then provided to the students at the Totino Grace school. I'd have to double check on the non-public transportation part of it. I'm not sure if those are general fund or community service fund as I think back about that. If they are in the general fund, the way this is structured right now, what we're doing is that would not be one of those areas that we're identifying a specific cost for buildings, and in fact it wouldn't relate to the building. That would be in this piece where we are lumping all of the other miscellaneous costs into an average per student, and then that would be attributed to each of the buildings across the district on an average per pupil basis, simply to try to reconcile with what the school district has reported as their total general fund expenditure.
Yes, Representative Bernardi, follow.
Thank you. I want this to be perfectly clear. It sounds like private.
I can say with certainty that the funds that flow through the school district on the way to the private school for textbooks, guidance and counseling, and health services, the non-public pupil aid, I know for sure that's in the community service fund. And that's not part of this calculation because we're looking strictly at the general fund.
Okay.
The part I'm not positive about is the pupil transportation part. I'm not sure, without going back and checking my UFARS manual, if that's part of the general fund or the community service fund.
And Mr. Chair, if we could get that information, I'd really appreciate that, because I'd like to make sure that that's not reflected against buildings or the school district for private school students. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meltzer, my question is more technical. I noticed on page 6, line 29, you talk about informing the principal of the building. And not all buildings have a principal, so I'm assuming the superintendent would be in charge of that principal. So I just wanted to make sure this language is sufficient for those exceptional circumstances where a principal doesn't exist in the building and maybe there's a lead teacher or some other head there that assists the superintendent.
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, our intent there was just simply to identify who, and currently the law says that the superintendent shall inform the site, and we weren't sure if it was clear what constituted informing the site. We were trying to clarify that by saying the principal, but certainly if there was not a principal at the site, if there was a lead teacher, whoever was in effect acting in that kind of a capacity, I'm assuming this would be broad enough to have that information go to that individual.
Thank you.
With the last question on this article, Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Melcher. Going back to page 9, paragraph B on lines 28 and 29, to Representative Latz's point, I'd like to offer a friendly amendment if Chair Sikora views it as friendly. I'll offer it. If she doesn't think it's friendly, I'll withdraw it. But on line 29, if we just scratched out the word whenever and inserted the word until, and scratched out the words fails to and added an S to submit, it would read like this: the commissioner may withhold the district's state aid for any school year until the district submits audited financial data. I think that would more clearly represent how you testified, and I think it would answer Representative Lance's question also.
Representative Sikora, would you like to accept that as a friendly amendment or not?
That's fine.
All those in favor of the amendment?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Thank you. With that, we will move past Article 1, one down, four to go. It could be a long morning if we don't exercise discipline as we go through.
Way to go.
Representative Sikora, do you have a witness for Article
2? Yes, we have two people here, Greg Marcus from the department and also Deputy Commissioner Marianne Nelson, who will go through some of these next things.
Mr. Marcus, Ms. Nelson, welcome.
Thank you. Greg Marcus from the department, and if with the chair's indulgence, I would like to approach the elements in Article 2 that I'm going to speak about in kind of a topical manner. If you would, turn to page 13 of your bills, Article 2, and we'll talk about the first and second sections there, and then also, if you'd be so kind as to turn to page 16 of your bill and circle line 20 there where it begins with Section 6. Those are the two. Those are the three areas, Section 1, 2, and 6 of Article 2 that I propose to speak about.
Thank you.
What they do, what these articles or sections do when combined, they provide a 30-day window during which schools and districts would have an opportunity to look at their AYP data and also the data that is used to construct their state report cards. And that data would then remain non-public until such time as that 30-day window had elapsed. We found through the department found through its first offering of AYP data that the MARS data that the districts had submitted and the department had subsequently used was in many instances very good, but not without error. That resulted in some districts showing up on a preliminary AYP list by virtue of the errors that they had in their MARS data and not by virtue of whether or not they had made AYP. So what we propose to do is to allow for this 30-day window. Last year, you recall that it began on July 7th and was finished on August 7th. That would be a time period during which the schools would have access to the data. They'd be able to check it for its accuracy. The parents would still be able to determine how it is that their school is doing in a general manner by speaking to the principal of the school. They're required to under federal law. But the press and some others would not be able to make any preliminary determinations based on what might be erroneous data. This is a department effort to try and allow this correction to happen in a manner that is less than the public eye. Ultimately, the data would be posted. The bill says, or the proposed language says, that by September 1, all this data gets posted. It becomes public at that point. And that's the sum of the result of Article Section 1, 2, and 6 of the of Article 2.
Thank you. Ms. Nelson, would you like to testify to other provisions of Article 2?
Mr. Chair, I would like to testify to provisions in Article 2, Subdivision 3, rulemaking on page 13 to begin. And given, representatives, all of you, given your discussion earlier in the amendment to delete all of Section 9 relating to social studies, this particular rule is related to social studies. So what it says is that it amends state statutes by adding social studies and science to the listing of standards for which the commissioner must adopt rules. And it says that you're requiring standards for language arts, math, and the arts, which you've already approved, must be implemented for all students beginning in the 2003-04 school year. But this includes the notation that those for science that you have not yet approved would be implemented beginning next school year, 2004-05, and those for social studies, which you have not yet approved, beginning in year 2005-06. So at this stage, this was prepared and is presented to you, and I'm not sure if there is feeling on the members that you want to delay this provision as well, but I present it to you that this is something that school districts have expressed some concern about. The original law called for both social studies and science to be implemented in the next school year, and it was the department's feeling that we wanted to respond to the timing and provide a little bit more flexibility for schools.
Thank you. Do either of you have any more testimony to offer as to Article 2?
Yes, I do. I'll continue. Section 4, social studies credits, clarification, and waivers for rigorous courses of study. This is on page 14 of your document. Page 14, line 29. We're trying to build in here as the department, we're trying to build in for schools flexibility with the standards to accommodate those students who take advanced courses of study. And so you'll see that one of the divisions talks about a waiver provision, and the one in previous, subdivision one, excuse me, on line 9, I'm sorry, talks about giving more flexibility with respect to the course requirements that the legislature enacted last year. And this relates to a letter that was sent by Commissioner Yeki to both Senator Kelly and Representative Sikora back in October. When we were doing hearings across the state, there were substantial input from school districts that what the legislature had passed relative to social studies was very prescriptive and difficult. We are proposing that the original language that was proposed for social studies, which stipulated 3.5 credits of social studies, including at least 1 credit of United States history, 1 credit of geography, 1/2 credit of government and citizenship, 1/2 credit of world history, and 1/2 credit of economics, that this be amended here to read more flexibly that social studies credits could mirror what you have already for math. So 3.5 credits of social studies encompassing at least U.S. history, geography, government and citizenship, world history, and economics. So those changes are marked in your document. Then, as I said earlier, moving forward, Mr. Chair, Subdivision 2, Rigorous Courses of Study. What is really stipulated on pages 14 and 15 is a procedure whereby schools, area learning centers, or charter schools have the authority to waive the credits for students who are taking international baccalaureate or advanced placement programs, which are widely recognized as very positive and a highly rigorous course of study. And this bill goes on to talk about another requirement that anyone under PSEO, Public School Enrollment Options Act, taking courses as a high school student in a college would also have the standards waived. And another provision on line 17 calls for the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota State Colleges, MNSCU, private colleges, to stipulate ahead of time and post for students which of their courses do prescribe with the standards. So it provides good notice to students. And then there's a final provision that protects students who entered ninth grade before the 2003-04 year and would also waive them their requirement to take the standard if they were enrolled in IB or AP classes. Continuing in Article 2, Section 5, gifted and talented. Mr. Chair, this particular provision of the bill was drafted in great length with the help of the Statewide Advisory Committee for Gifted and Talented, which is comprised of representatives from school districts, the Minnesota Council for the Gifted and Talented, Minnesota Educators of the Gifted and Talented, and post-secondary institutions that provide teachers gifted education training. And there is a perceived need that gifted education has not received the focus that many people feel is rightly due to students who are enrolled in those kinds of programs. And this particular provision spells out a gifted and talented program development and student identification. It continues on page 16 in your bill. And it calls for you stating that it is critical for gifted and talented students to be identified and appropriately served. And so what this provision does is lay out a procedure by which students, certain features of an identification system to identify students who are gifted and talented. And with that, Mr. Chair, that would end my testimony on Article 2.
Thank you. With that, Representative Demmer, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question relates to the timing of the information that comes from the schools for the report card and the posting by September 1st on the website. I think it's a great idea to give a little time there. The thought that I have, is there any thought given or is it practical to think about having the posting date by August 1st maybe instead of September 1st to give parents a little time to look at that data prior to school beginning? If it's posted, you know, August 31st or whatever school starts a day or two after, there wouldn't be time to look at that if you wanted to in choosing schools. Was there thought given to that? Is there practical limitations or could you speak to that?
Mr. Marcus.
Mr. Chair. Representative, an excellent suggestion. I think that what the department was trying to convey there is that the data will certainly all be public by that, no later than that date. However, certainly we would make it available as soon as it was accurate. The 30-day window begins once the department has posted the preliminary data, that private, what we propose to make non-public data, and then during that 30-day window, after the end of the 30-day window, then the data would be calculated and posted. So that would probably be, you could make a, if I can find the precise language in there, that might be okay. Thank you. Yes. No. Okay. It does say no later than September 1, indeed. So it would be our intention to post it as soon as the districts had their 30 days, and that could fall as early as August 7th, as it did in this last year, or it could fall even earlier than that, depending upon when the test vendors turn around data and other things of that nature.
Follow-up, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So again, it's my understanding then, it's possible whenever a school district gets their data in, that's when the 30-day window starts, so it's going to be different for every school district. So if I go out and look for a school district on August 15th and their data's not up, I can assume they're still in their 30-day window, but regardless, by September 1st, it will be posted. So if I don't get my data until August 20th as a school district, I only got a 10-day window. Is that accurate?
Mr. Marcus.
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer. No, the schools would all get their preliminary data at the same time as they did this last year. All schools got their preliminary data on July 7th. All schools got their final would be true. Whatever time, 30 days after whatever time all districts received their preliminary data, the public data would be posted.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, a question of the department. I want to go back to Section 3, the rulemaking and the social studies. Science. As I read that, it would appear that if this section were to become law and the commissioner were to adopt the rules, then the social studies curriculum, which is the one that was the centerpiece of the discussion the other day, would be adopted. And is that interpretation correct?
The intention is not in any way to have language in front of you that indicates you have adopted any curriculum at this time, any standards, I should say.
What it is merely an attempt to do is to lay out the timing for implementations of whatever standards come before this body and are eventually adopted. But I pulled in front of you that I can understand there might be a point of confusion on that, Representative.
Representative Carlson.
We may be reading this differently, but I am reading it that if this were to pass into law, that the commissioner would then adopt the rules. And once the rules are adopted, the social studies curriculum would be in place. That's what it seems to tell me. And in light of the comments, I guess my next question would be of the author, Representative Cora, in light of the earlier comments that we would be dealing with the social studies standards with a later bill, would it not be best maybe to drop the discussion as well and have a discussion at that point in time?
Representative Sikora?
I agree with Representative Carlson, Mr. Chairman. This was intended to just lay out what the procedure will be. But since everybody's a little paranoid about it, actually, saying that we've adopted social studies standards and allowed her to go ahead with rules, we'll just add it onto the standards bill, which will be coming up in a couple of weeks. So it'll become part of the standards bill instead of this bill.
So,
then you're.
If I could make that motion, then I think there's concurrence with the author.
I thought I was making the motion to delete it.
I understood, Representative Sikora, that you were making an author's amendment to delete.
Right.
Is that all of Section 3, so that would be page 13, lines 24 through page 14, line 5. Is that correct?
Sorry, I'm not even looking at the right page right now. Which page is it? 13.
I had a start on page 13, line 24.
Okay. Yes.
Yes. Through page 14, line 5.
That's correct.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah, I believe that's correct. And it's your amendment then to delete that at this time. Is that right?
That's right.
All right. Representative Krinke to this point.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sikora, if you're then going to look at adding this language to the standards legislation.
Well,
Representative Sikora.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krinke, there's going to be a bill on standards, and I am carrying it. However, we have another hearing on the social studies standards on next week, Thursday. So, you know, that bill has not been put together, but we will make sure this goes into that bill instead of into the department bill.
Well,
okay?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Krinke.
Any bill that contains rulemaking authority has got to go to GovOp. Yeah. So if you want the standards bill to go to GovOp because you have rulemaking authority in it?
Not particularly.
Representative
Sikora.
Well, then then I would suggest that that the bill needs to, I mean,
Representative
until Krinke? Such time that people feel comfortable with what this provision is, any bill that contains rulemaking authority under House rule has to go to GovOp.
Representative Sikora.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krinke, this bill will go from rule, from GovOp to education finance.
Representative Krinke.
Mr. Chairman.
And
Representative Sikora, I don't care where it goes.
It'll probably
I'm just
be in the omnibus finance bill is what I'm saying. It may or may not. I'm not sure.
Anyway.
If not, it'll have to go to rules.
All right.
But it had to go to rules anyway. I mean, pardon me, it had to go to GovOps anyway because it has another little council thing in it.
Okay.
But this is the standards bill, and yes, I suppose it'll have to do that. So it'll have a longer route. But I don't want anybody thinking I'm trying to put something over on somebody, which is the, you know, the feeling some members here have. And I'm certainly not trying to do that.
As to Representative Sikora's author's amendment, all in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
Thank you. Next, Representative Pulaski, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is on page 15, section C, lines 17 through 27. Could someone from the department tell me if the University of Minnesota or the Minsky system or the private college system has been consulted with the language that's in paragraph C?
I don't have the information for you at this time.
Then could someone from the department tell me that if I would characterize paragraph C as applying Leave No Child Behind to our higher educational systems as well as to K through 12, would that be an accurate interpretation of what you're doing here in paragraph C?
Ms. Nelson.
No, I would not see that in any way, shape, or form, actually. What it's saying is if we're going to do waivers and we're going to allow students who take college-level courses, we're just asking that those courses that are offered be designated as to students and parents so that they know which ones do indeed meet the standards. And those are the broad broad standards approved by the state. So the compliance of No Child Left Behind to MESRS is very different.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Plaskett. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I do have a concern about paragraph C, since the department cannot tell me if any of the higher education boards or even the private college council has been consulted. Can the department tell me who requested this information be inserted in this bill?
Ms. Nelson.
I guess I really don't have the information. I certainly can get it and provide it to you, but I have to be honest, I don't want to speak and say something I don't have knowledge of.
Very good. Representative Sikora?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe this was part of the language that was under the old profiles language. But when we deleted the profile, we deleted all the language that went with it. So we have to restore this language. I think this is current practice.
Mr. Chair.
And it would not apply to social studies because social studies standards are not a federal requirement. So if you're worried about the federal requirement, social studies aren't even a federal requirement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sikora, that gives me some comfort, but not very much. I appreciate that clarification. And, Mr. Chair, I'll stop asking questions and I'll consult with Lisa Larson. But I do have concerns about that paragraph.
May I ask Ms. Larson to please state whether or not, wasn't that correct, that this is language that was under the old profile?
Speak into that
one. Ms. Larson, you can run, but you can't hide.
Here you are. I know she was trying to get away.
Madam Chair, members, I believe when the commissioner appeared before the committee, she indicated that we had inadvertently repealed a portion of the rigorous courses studied under the profile affecting AP and IB courses and also PSEO courses. And the language that you see in paragraph C is the same language that we had previously under the profile for the rigorous course exemption. I believe that the duty of the post-secondary institutions can be significant or can be minimal depending upon how they approach this. But this is the same process that we had previously when we created the rigorous course exemption under the profile.
Representative Plaskett.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Larson, a follow-up, and they do this now.
Yes. Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Plaskett, I believe that's correct.
Well, thank you, Ms. Larson. I'll reserve any further comment until we get absolute clarification.
Representative Slaughter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I know we're running out of time, but just a suggestion is maybe if we had some of these bills ahead of time, we could get some of our questions clarified. I'm concerned about page 16, subdivision 2, student identification, as it looks like to me, and I look, Commissioner Representative Sikora, that looks a bit like an unfunded mandate to me. There's no additional funds for schools, no additional staff. I don't know, maybe there's a fiscal note with this. But with the IEP process, there's a similar process that goes on. It takes a lot of staff time, takes a lot of identification in here. You're supposed to use an assessment instrument. There's seven items here that schools are supposed to do for gifted learners. However, what I hear from my school is there's no money. So I'm wondering, is there a fiscal note attached to this? Have you priced out how much this is going to cost per school? This is basically mandating student identification of gifted learners, which we do, of course, special ed learners at this point, which I would think would come with quite a price tag.
Ms. Nelson, would you like to address that?
In the past, this legislature has had funding allocated specifically for gifted ed. as a former superintendent of schools, it's pretty much a basic expectation that gifted education services are provided by districts. I believe that is in place in most districts in some way, in some form. What this is, when I look at it, having reviewed it, I don't believe that this is anything unusual. It's fairly broad standards in terms of what gifted education should be. The advantage of having it stated here is it puts a focus on the needs of those students and prescribes in broad terms an assessment system that should be in place for students. There were other recommendations made, I should say, as well by this particular advisory committee, and given recognition of budget finances, many of those were not brought forward. And this one was felt to be broad level guidance for school districts that would promote their practices as well as enhance the education of students who are gifted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawick.
So there is no additional funding, but additional initial mandated requirements.
That's correct.
Ms. Nelson. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a question that I had too. Is this an unfunded mandate? And it looks like that it is. What I'm concerned is that I would like us to enhance and strengthen our current programming that we're doing and not dismantle what we're doing. And so what I want to know, are they going to be required to do what you're saying here? And then are they going to be required to be doing anything differently than they're currently doing? Because I know my school district is doing what it can within its means, and we would like to improve and enhance the program. I certainly don't want to have to dismantle it because of this legislation.
Ms. Nelson.
Well, because I know of your school district, having been there for 9 years as superintendent, no, I don't believe that this would dismantle what's in place. I think these statements are broad enough and are not an attempt to say a specific assessment system, but this is very much in the minds and discussions of parents in terms of that this is an important part of education. We spend a lot of time on special ed. We have gifted ed students with needs, and the intention was to have broad standards.
And just one follow-up, Mr. Chair, if it's real quick.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to know, will school districts be susceptible to law school if somebody doesn't feel that they're following this law?
Ms. Nelson.
Well, that's a legal question. Would somebody be subject to a lawsuit? Is that what you asked?
Yeah, would a school district be subject to a lawsuit if they're not doing this for students if we make it law?
They don't have the money.
Ms. Nelson, if you feel qualified to answer that question, you certainly...
I really don't feel I have legal background to provide. I wouldn't think anyone's subject to lawsuit anymore for this as they are other features in the bill. And if I apply that same thinking to everything in the bill...
Yeah, Ms. Nelson, I didn't mean to put you... Dr. Nelson, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I was just wondering, because special ed... there are lawsuits when those things aren't followed. I was wondering if this would be in comparison to that. I'm not sure.
Special ed is governed by a very different and much more prescriptive sense of a set of rules that are very technical in terms of notification. They're federal and state. We have a whole division at the department that monitors this. As far as gifted ed, it gets a very, very small part of that kind of monitoring. So I guess I would feel confident saying no.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Grayling, is it to this point?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, to this point.
All right.
I think it's a really wonderful idea to identify students. I'm just concerned about on page 16, lines 2 and 3, where it says it's critical to identify them and appropriately serve gifted and talented students. And so to have broad-based standards at the state level to identify students, I think is excellent. However, I think it has shallow meaning in the implementation to say that students be appropriately served when we aren't doing anything. We're giving the assessment and talking about comparing it to special ed and the time that those students get and the money that they get when that isn't in this bill. Mm-hmm. So I realize that we boxed ourselves in with funding for education and actually cut it last year. But to give districts the ability to identify and have it be somewhat uniform, I think is a tiny step in the right direction. But I think it's a pretty shallow unfunded mandate when it is unfunded and we don't recognize that and appropriately served is the more important thing. Because as Dr. Nelson said, most districts already do identify their gifted and talented students. They may not use this method, but they use some method, and there's students that really get served and students that don't. I'm working with one myself this year. My intern is from the Mentor Connection, and that's just a tiny tip of the iceberg type of program for students who are very extremely gifted, and I'm pleased to be working with her. But I'm very concerned that this is all we're doing for gifted students, that that we are not even hearing the bills that some of the people on this side of the aisle have offered in that regard. And so I would just say that, a baby step to be complimented, but let's not get too excited about it.
Representative Denver, did you have a question to this point?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is to this point. I guess in reading through this, and I appreciate where we're coming from. I don't see this as saying that school districts are required or forced to be doing this particular thing. My understanding, I think schools right now have multiple ways, and some probably do better than other at identifying gifted and talented and have different ways of implementing programs. I know down in our districts, in my districts, the Zumbra Education District provided a lot of gifted and talented. And they changed that, and now districts are doing it on their own, and I think they do it in different ways. I was just reading through this, and to me, it says that we find it critical to identify them, and it says they are assessed, and consideration includes, but I don't see any place where it says that a school district shall do anything. And so I'm thinking that, to my way of reading this, it's ideas and it's really quite passive, to be honest about it, in terms of the way I read this. So I'm not sure we are mandating anything here.
Members, in order to keep moving on, we've got two more.
Could I ask a follow-up on that one?
Very brief follow-up. Representative Breiland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Demmer, I read it the same way you do, which is why it is meaningless.
Okay. Was there a question, Representative Breiland?
Mr. Chair, that was my comment.
Oh, okay.
And Mr. Chair, unless there is something more to it than Representative Demmer and I have read, in which case I would like to hear that, because I would be encouraged if it was stronger than Representative Demmer interprets.
Representative Demmer, you get one more rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would submit this as an opportunity for school districts to differentiate themselves.
I was actually asking the chair of the testifiers if they saw something in it that Representative Demmer and I do not.
At this point, Representative Greiling, we're going to move on. So, we're going to continue till 10 after and get as deep into the bill as we can at that point. We have two more questions as to this article, one from Representative Erickson and one from Representative Seifert. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify that I think Subdivision 2, student identification, in addition to the purpose statement, really strengthens what teachers can do in classrooms, because the word is consideration. And so now as a classroom teacher, I have a series of statements in law that give me some flexibility to identify gifted students within my own classroom if we don't have an organized program, especially at the high school level. So I think language like this allows lots of flexibility, and I thank the department for including it.
Thank you. Representative Seifert.
Right. Mr. Chair, I guess I just have the simple question why it's necessary or why we're doing it. We're doing it now in all of our schools that have gifted and talented, have various ways. Talking on the side with Representative Carlson, some students are gifted in music, but they may not be gifted in science and math. And if we're doing it now and the local schools know what they're doing, I don't know, I'm kind of the repealer in chief, so I usually like not to put things in statute. And legislature findings, we've been, at least in the last 5 years, been trying not to put legislative findings in statute, because a lot of it is just, yeah, we like this, but, there's no money for it, or here's some criteria. And I just see it as unnecessary, but that's just my side of things. And you know, on line 7 with objective and subjective. I don't know that we've ever put anything like subjective in a statute before, because it's, you know, the very meaning of the word is, you know, figure it out and do it for yourself. So I don't know that it's necessary, but I'm just, that's just my comment of not putting more things in the statute books than what are needed.
Representative Sikora.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seifert, I think what we're trying to do here is remind everybody that we aren't just here to look at students that are low students that are in danger of not meeting their adequate yearly progress, et cetera. We have so much focus on that right now that I think it's good to remind people that we have also gifted students who I personally feel aren't getting as much attention as they should, and hopefully we can put some money into a program for gifted next time around. I don't know when we're going to have enough money to do it, but I think it's really important. I think the gifted community is a very important group, and I think we should be always thinking in terms of what we can do for our best kids in addition to what we can do for our children who aren't making it.
With that, members, we'll move to Article 3. Let's see if we can't at least get through Article 3 before we adjourn. Oh.
Is Barb Pace and Greg Marcus.
Put it in the law book, which we don't care.
Thank you. Will you approach and identify yourself, please?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Barbara Case. I'm an acting manager with the Division of Compliance and Assistance at the department. We deal mainly with special education, oversight, and maltreatment of minors.
Thank you, Ms. Case. Are you testifying to another portion of Article 2 or to Article 3?
Article 3, Mr. Chair. Going through then section by section, under Article 3 Special Programs, the first is a change to the definition section, which would include the department maltreatment investigations within the definition of welfare system. And this, the purpose of this is to protect the status of department data related to an investigation of child maltreatment or abuse, essentially to make it treated the same as investigations by other agencies. Section 2, online learning parameters. This section strikes language making an individualized education plan team determine a condition for allowing a special education student to enroll in online course or program and requires the individual education team to adapt the student's individualized education plan to reflect online learning option. Section 3 amends the definition of interagency intervention service system to indicate that disabled children birth to 21 instead of 3 to 21 are eligible to receive services and programs under state and federal special education law. I think this just brings this section into current practice with other statutes, current practice with what we're doing. Section 4, State Interagency Committee, changes the composition of the governor-convened State Interagency Committee to add two parent representatives. Section 5, Special Instruction for Children with Disability, requires school districts to provide special instruction and services to disabled children who are suspended or expelled from school for more than 5 days. I think this just makes clear what is already current practice in the state. Section 6 directs the commissioner to adopt rules by June 1st, 2004 instead of January 1st, 2004 on the requirements of special education hearing officers. We've already had the rule hearings. The rules are almost completed, but we obviously did not make the deadline. Mm-hmm.
I do.
Thank you. Representative Seifert, do you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, page 26, line 34. I find it hard to believe that in changing statute, meeting the needs of eligible children with disabilities and changing from 3 to 21 to birth through 21 is not going to have some type of fiscal impact. I just find that hard to believe, and we may just be striking two words and adding two words, but that is an enormous, enormous change of what we're doing. And if we're not backing things up with our wallet and we're just thinking out loud, this is a really big change without having any fiscal ramifications.
Representative Seifert, I understand that is aligning with current practice, so it doesn't represent a new cost, but rather represents what was needing to be done under federal law currently.
Representative Greiley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 20, I think it's something to be supported doing it, but if it's current practice, I'm fine with that. Otherwise, I was going to question the thinking it was words that weren't backed up with money again, too. But my question is, and I think it's a really good section, and it's certainly something that we should do, whether it's funded or not, and if it's funded, so much the better. On page 29, lines 20 through 23, I had a call this morning from someone from the mental health community who was suggesting on line 22 that we might want to consider revising that language where it says the governor shall appoint two parents representative of a child or youth who is eligible and is receiving coordinated services. The language change would be suggested to be is eligible to receive, and the question being would there be enough parents that would actually have students who are receiving already coordinated services, and would that then, if we left it worded that way, block parents of children from the mental health community who tend to be the ones not receiving coordinated services? And to me, that would be the most important type of parent to include, because they are the most needy in terms of needing to receive coordinated services.
Ms. Kate.
Representative Greiling, Mr. Chair, I think it's a good point. There are probably many families who have children who are eligible for the coordinated services who actually haven't accessed them, and I can't think of any reason why they shouldn't be eligible to be on it simply because they aren't receiving the services now.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chair, then I would make that amendment and hope it would be friendly to the author of the bill. On page 29, line 22, changing and is receiving coordinated services to and is eligible to receive coordinated services.
Representative Sikora.
All right, I think I'd like to suggest it be a little different. Just the only thing you need to change is line 22, who is eligible for special education coordinated services, and leave it at that. Just eliminate and is receiving. Mm-hmm. Okay, Representative Brown?
Representative Brown.
Representative Segrin, that accomplishes it in an even more streamlined manner, but the same difference. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So the change, members, is on line 22. Delete the word receiving and replace it with the words eligible for. Is that correct, Representative Sikora?
No.
Eliminate and is receiving.
Oh, just delete the and is receiving.
Right.
So we've now shortened the bill. All right. Thank you. Representative Segrin.
It's another issue.
Can we just read it one more time? I think
sure.
I got it right. Read it. Can you read it, the change again?
It's my understanding that the insert would now read, beginning on line 20, the governor shall appoint two parent representatives of a child or youth who is eligible for special education coordinated services from public agencies. Is that correct, Representative Sikora? All in favor of the amendment?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Is there anything else as to Article 3? Any other questions? Representative Biernet.
Section 6, Article 3.
Thank you.
It seems like the department didn't meet its charge of having its deadline by January 1, and now it's changing the deadline to June 1 and making it retroactive, like they never had that responsibility. Like, it's kind of puzzling how they're getting around the law by changing the law and making it retroactive as if the law never existed.
Thank you. With that, I think we will conclude our discussion of this bill for today. Our odds of getting that Wednesday 8:15 meeting are going up. I think that the other thing that we have not done is approve the minutes from the meeting of February 3rd. I'll entertain a motion from Representative Erickson.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I approve the minutes. I did read them. They're minutes from February 3rd.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. With that, the meeting's adjourned.